Welcome to episode 29 of the Wake Up Podcast. As mentioned in our prior episode, I have a special guest on today, Mr. Scott Horton from Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com, author of Enough Already, that I believe is his latest book, and The Great Ron Paul. Scott's one of the more well-known libertarians, particularly in the foreign policy and the anti-war element of the broader libertarian movement, and he's a brilliant guy, very articulate. And for those of you who are listening who know me more from my Bitcoin content, this is less a Bitcoin podcast and more a podcast about, you know, the libertarian ethos and how also, you know, we really discussed, like, you know, war was obviously a big topic, America as the empire was quite a central topic, and how that is at odds with America the Republic, particularly the Federated Republic that America was originally founded to be. We spoke geopolitics, you know, we spoke about the atrocities of basically any president of the state, particularly the United States, in recent times. Scott's got some interesting views across basically, well, not interesting views, but very factually driven positions on what, you know, what so-called leaders have been doing to people in other countries that have nothing to do with them directly. It's crazy. This is a really eye-opening interview. We're going to do a part two, where we're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, the monopoly on money, and particularly how that actually funds things like the monopoly on violence, etc. So I really enjoyed this call. I'm going to venture out and do a series of shows with people that aren't directly in the Bitcoin space, so that we can get to a broader audience. So if you enjoyed this, if you know anyone who, you know, this is up their alley, please pass it on. And as usual, subscribe to the channel, and I'll see you on the next episode. And we are live with episode 29 of the Wake Up Podcast. And on today's show, I have a very special guest, someone who is quite different to the traditional Bitcoin-dominated guests that I have. He's one of the more well-known libertarians, Scott Horton, who's also the director of the Libertarian Institute. He's the editorial director of antiwar.com. He's the host of The Scott Horton Show, and he's got a series of books. We've got Fool's Errand, The Great Ron Paul, and I believe there's one behind him there called Enough Already. So, Scott, thank you for taking some time to come on the show, buddy.
Happy to be here. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good, other than a sore tooth. But let's get into this in the spirit of time, because I want to make the most of the 80, 90 minutes that we've got. So I'm going to dive right in with one question, which is, actually, before I do this, can you give me, other than this short little version, can you give me and the listeners, you know, for those people who may not know you, sort of the 5-minute version of, you know, where you spend most of your time today, and a little bit about the breadcrumbs that got you there. And I know it'll be hard in 5 minutes, but let's see what you can do.
Sure. Well, up until very recently, I've been spending all of my days working on the book. So that's been, you know, my preoccupation. I plan very soon to start writing regular articles for antiwar.com again. I have, you know, quite a few there in my archive. And then I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute, which is, you know, a bunch of great guys. Of course, the heroic Sheldon Richman, who's a legend in the libertarian movement, going back for decades. And then Pete Quinones and Kyle Anzalone, mm-hmm. were both, you know, up and comers in the libertarian movement. And Kyle also works for antiwar.com as well. And then we got a bunch of great writers and all that. So that's a broader focus than just the non-interventionist stuff, which is my primary focus. But mm-hmm. we also have that great group there. And it was founded with Will Grigg, except he died about 6 months later after we created the thing. But mm-hmm. he was really one of the greats of the libertarian movement, died back in 2017. But anyway, so that's, you know, the most important project really that I'm working on right now is the Libertarian Institute and trying to get this book out. And then I've been doing interviews. I started doing an interview show and recording them and posting them on the internet in April of 2003. So I got 5,400 interviews at scotthorton.org in the archives there.
A real OG. Jesus.
Yeah. So that might be the most interviews that anybody posted in one place on the internet or something. I'm not sure. And they're almost all about foreign policy going all the way back. You know, that's pretty much it. Just your run-of-the-mill anti-government extremism with a focus on anti-imperialism, especially. But I'm a Rothbardian libertarian, you know. Yep. As far as the different libertarian sects, I'm very.
Okay, I think for me, Rothbard is, like, I've said this on many podcasts as well. I think for me, Rothbard is one of the clearest, most consistent, most well thought out thinkers, probably in almost all of history. So I think you and I probably really get along on that. So thank you for that. I'm going to hit my first question then. I've heard a couple of your podcasts, and, you know, one recently with Dave Smith, and I've heard you multiple times say, you know, the foreign policy is the most important aspect of a presidency or a nation state's impact. So, you know, I want to ask, why do you think that is specifically?
Yeah, well, especially in an empire, foreign policy dominates every other thing. And so, you know, especially if you think back to the Bush years, you heard this more often. Now it kind of just goes without saying, but X or Y priority has to wait, because don't you know there's a war on? Or even worse, this or that liberty must be eroded. Your privacy must be eroded. Your due process protections must be eroded, because don't you know there's a war on? Foreign danger. You ever see in the movie JFK, Donald Sutherland is Mr. X, and he meets with Jim Garrison on the park bench in Washington, D.C., and he points at all the white marble, you know, monuments of political power there on the mall. And he says, what is all this? What are we doing here? What is this? It's the war power. That is the organizing force in any society. And the fight over who controls that war power is everything. In that case, they're talking about, would somebody shoot a president in the face over that? Yeah, they would, right? In this case, or we can talk about that in any case, that this is what it's all about, is who controls the Pentagon, who controls the Pentagon budget, and who controls what we're doing with that armed force. Now, if America was a humble, little old commercial constitutional republic, then it wouldn't matter so much. We wouldn't have a standing army, or we'd barely have one. We'd have a Navy fit for national defense, not for global dominance. And then it wouldn't be as much of an issue. Have you ever read 1984 by George Orwell?
Of course. Yep.
So, and it's funny because people always reference, you know, cameras everywhere and Big Brother surveillance, but they forget that the backdrop of the whole story is emergency.
Constant
We're
war.
At war with East Asia or Eurasia, whichever day of the week it is, but that the reason you have to go without is because of the war. The reason we have to have an IRS to take this money right out of your bank account is because otherwise the bad guys are going to get you. The reason we have to have not a federal republic at all, but a centralized United State of America is to protect from the enemy, the communists, the terrorists, whoever it is. And so the Chinese, you know, again, next, even though they're not, we ended the Cold War with them almost 50 years ago, and now we're creating a new one with them for money's sake, right? To sell. Why? Is it because of something the Chinese did? That's not what it is. You know, Rex Tillerson, who was the CEO of Exxon, who became Donald Trump's first Secretary of State, he told Bob Woodward, this is his exact words, the Chinese threaten American domination of the Pacific. Mm-hmm. Right? Not they threaten our right to travel freely through it, but the entire Pacific Ocean is an American lake, and we won't settle for 99% of it. And if the Chinese think that they have the right to control anything beyond 12 miles off of their own coast, they're going to find out the hard way. And the reason behind it all is just to sell aircraft carriers. to sell long-range bombers, to keep a $1 trillion national security state budget going. Every year we've had $1 trillion budgets every year. As William Lind, the great military strategist, said, that is the greatest honeypot in the history of the world. There's nothing that compares to that. And so Lockheed, and you go down the list, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, General Atomics, and General Dynamics, and SIAC, and all of these major contractors, they spend consistently every year with purpose. They spend chump change, mere hundreds of thousands of dollars each in some cases, low millions of dollars each, to bankroll the think tanks that write this, where the eggheads write the studies that say why this is all necessary. They spend peanuts lobbying Congress, buying them steak dinners, buying ads to run on the Sunday morning news shows, to always show us stealth bombers by Northrop Grumman and remind us, where would we be without these people? And where would NBC be without their money consistently coming in? And it's just a big corrupt game. In any other industry, they call it the revolving door, right? But in the national security state, it's usually more referred to as something like the Iron Triangle, right? The military-industrial complex, the military-industrial everything complex, right? The media, academia, science, Silicon Valley, and whatever you got. And really, if you run a business of any major import in the country at all, if you have a, say you make boots, you're a major boot company, and there's how many in America? I don't know. Let's say there's 100 of them. They've got to fight like dogs for who gets the Army and the Marine Corps contract. Otherwise, you're just letting your competition kill you. So if all you ever wanted to do was make good work boots, now you have to be part of the military-industrial complex, because that's part of it. Even down to who gets the contract for the toothpaste and the boots, never mind for the ammo, the missiles, the bombs, the planes, and all the equipment, all the batteries, and all the everything. It's remember that movie, The War Dogs, that came out? They start out, they said, war is an economy. That's the first line in the movie. War is an economy. And then they show like a price tag over the head of every little soldier running around Iraq, and how much it cost to have all the equipment on his back and the gun in his hand and the Apache helicopter flying overhead and all the rest.
So, okay. So two things I want to ask. So one is, I mean, in the sense of how libertarians generally frame things is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is what we're saying is a monopoly on the ability to enact violence is the root of all of this, right? Is because if I come and punch you in the face, you can go and call somebody, and then they can use violence on me to, you know, and rightfully so in some sense. Like if I was to unprovoked come and punch you, but if the state decides to just come and punch someone in the face or shoot them or kill them or bomb them, but then it's okay because of war or because of this boogeyman that is defense, right? So could we agree that the monopoly on violence is sort of the central issue, or do you think it's also just broader than just the monopoly on violence element?
No, again, that's it. It's the fight over who has control over the war power, right? That monopoly that you're talking about. And that's all politics is. And really, you know, I used to be a lot, kind of a conspiracy nut in the 1990s when I was a kid. And I remember a guy riding in my cab said to me, he goes, listen, all the stuff that you're saying is right, but it ain't conspiracy, man. It's just politics. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's what politics is. Politics is the game, the fight over who controls the power. And we're talking about lethal force, absolutely. And look, they've killed millions of people. And again, they control trillions of dollars. And so the fight over that is, of course, then a blood sport, you know?
So is that desire to own the monopoly on violence, would you say that's the end, though? Or is that more of a means to another end? Like what's your feedback there? Like, do you think that is what they want?
Or I'll go back to Orwell.
Yeah, they, and I say they.
Yeah, I go back to Orwell. I mean, that's the line in 1984 when O'Brien is torturing Winston. Power is not a means, it is an end. Power is the ability to control other men, and especially to tear their minds apart and put them back together again in new shapes of your own choosing. 2 + 2 = what, Winston? That's the end. Well, that's the end is power.
Okay, so my other question here was going to be, you know, why are wars so enticing for a state? But I think you've sort of answered that in this introduction. So I've got a varied set of questions here, but I'll go to the move to the next one because I want to see where we go with this. Is in your mind, is modern what's different about modern warfare versus how we used to fight a couple hundred years ago, maybe 1,000 years ago, and further, you know, before that? Like, what do you, in your mind, think is the primary difference between either the missions, you know, or the outcomes, or the purpose behind waging war? Do you think that's changed, or do you think it's always sort of had the same root? And what is different about it today?
Well, you know, you have the nation states, the real consolidated nation states come into being in Western Europe in the early 1600s, right, with the Treaty of Westphalia and all of that. Mm-hmm. So at that point, the armies get bigger. And of course, you have the Industrial Revolution. So the technologies of mass killing get, you know, more and more effective. And you can see, especially in the 20th century, the scale, the lethality of the weapons. And especially like if you compare between the First and the Second World War and the way, you know, the advances in machine guns and bombs and aerial, all kinds of things and all these things. Then the real invention, the major turning point is 1945. Because once the Americans invented nukes, now the major powers can't fight each other anymore. Well, hopefully. I mean, they act like it's a Mexican standoff where everybody's pointing a gun at each other and then nobody's ever going to fire. But if you ever seen Reservoir Dogs, sometimes they all fire, you know? Mexican standoff is not necessarily the best way to keep the peace on a permanent basis, but that's how it's been. Of course, this is a blink of an eye, right? 1945 to 2020 is no time at all. So you can say, well, mutually assured destruction has worked really well to keep the peace between the major powers. Yeah, up until the moment it doesn't. And then we all die on one afternoon. Our whole civilization is destroyed in one afternoon. And maybe all of Northern human civilization is destroyed. And the people in the global South are set back 5,000 years. I mean, or worse, you know, absolutely billions nuked and starved to death in the event of a real war between, say, America and Russia, or even America and China. China only has like 300 nukes. That's enough to completely level everything between Canada and Mexico of any value, any importance whatsoever. Every one of our major cities and the ability of our society to exist would be gone in a day. So luckily, that hasn't been the case. And so, in fact, if you go from World War II to Korea to, well, in Vietnam was an escalation from Korea. You went from about 2 million killed to about 3 million killed there. But then maybe that was just because of the length of the war. But then since then, you actually have wars getting less lethal, which is not to play them down. I mean, I just wrote a book about how I'm against every war since 1979, my whole life long here. So I'm not saying that. But if you look at Iraq War II, they did not carpet bomb Baghdad the way that Nixon, you know, LBJ and Nixon carpet bombed North Vietnam. I mean, for people who are not familiar with that, carpet means cover the entire area with explosions from this grid marker to that grid marker so that no living thing could possibly survive. Cover it like carpet with explosions. Well, they didn't do that to Iraq. I mean, man, did they destroy the hell out of Iraq. They ruined it. And you know what? Hell, they might as well have dropped an atom bomb on Baghdad, as bad as they destroyed that country. But they didn't do that. They didn't do that. And about 1 million died out of a population of about 25 million. It could have been a lot worse, and as bad as it was. And so, you know, it seems like possibly there's a trend down in deaths. Even if you look at the war in Libya and in Syria, the war in, I mean, see, I don't know, man, it depends on how you measure it, right? If we're individualists here, then, you know, all of this is even the slightest bit is a tragedy. But
yeah,
in the scale of things, there are some that are worse than others. And I should mention Somalia and Yemen are as bad as Iraq War II or Syria, where you do have hundreds of thousands of people killed. And in Yemen, officially so far, it's 100,000+. But I guarantee you, when they calculate it's the higher, excess death yeah. rate, it's going to be better than 500,000 killed there. And Somalia is the same way. USA has been beaten up on Somalia since 2001. People don't know that. Liberals go, oh, you think freedom works, Mr. Libertarian? Why don't you move to Somalia?
Go to Somalia, yeah.
But that's not freedom. Freedom was working in Somalia from 1998 through 2001 when George W. Bush, the leader of the greatest power in the history of all of mankind, sent his Joint Special Operations Command and CIA to start butchering them and has never stopped since. And goes to show what a liberal knows about all of this stuff when they're supposed to be anti-war. And they're going to bring up an American war zone as an example of freedom failing because they don't know the first thing about who's killing who in Somalia, even though it's their own government that's responsible for every bit of it this whole time and not stopped through Bush, Obama, and Trump. And now Biden, I don't know if you saw the headline yesterday, Biden escalating in Somalia, bombing the crap out of them. Starving them to death again. By the hundreds Jesus of thousands. Christ.
So, okay, so Somalia is an interesting example. What is the reason, what's the raison d'etre for the US to go in and do that to such a small nation that is so insignificant? Like, what are they gaining in doing this?
Well, they like to pretend that they believe that there's a threat to control over the Red Sea. That if you had like, oh, the terrorists control Somalia, then they'll stop shipping, you know, through from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. Which is just a joke. I mean, when has the world ever had a problem with the Somalis shutting down global trade or something? They're just making up lies. They want to dominate that area. They want to have a friendly government in Mogadishu that lets them dominate the area to prevent the Chinese or anyone else from dominating it. And hilariously, the Americans and the Chinese both have military bases in Djibouti, just north of Somalia, right there, and both with the same mission, to make sure nobody tries to close the gates of the Red Sea, which no one would try to do anyway. Who the hell's going to try to close the Red Sea? Is there a lost continent of Atlantis that's at war with the Western powers right now that I didn't know about? Some invisible, you know, continent in the sky at war with us that goes unnamed? There's no threat. It's all pretend. And yet, if you want to know what their excuse was, in 2001, their excuse was, well, we heard there are some Islamists. And so what happened was, and I'll do this as fast as I can, the CIA went in there and Joint Special Operations Command, top tier special operations forces went into. And the first thing that they did was start bribing the warlords who were the bad guys from last time during Black Hawk Down in 1993, when Adid, the warlord, and his men with bin Laden's men's help brought down American helicopters and killed Rangers and Delta operators there. Well, it was Adid's son and his friends were the ones who got all the money from the CIA in 2001. And what was their job? Hunt down and kill Islamists. But they're warlords. So what do? They lord war over the people of Somalia. You're going to do what we say or we'll kill you. And then the more the people of Somalia resist, the more they come crying back to the CIA. We need more money and more guns because look at all the resistance. It's Islamist terrorists, bin Ladenite terrorists are resisting us. Give us more, more, more. And the more the CIA gives them, the more they oppress the people, the more the people fight back. By end of 2004, beginning of 2005, this what had been a prosperous state of essentially default de facto anarcho-capitalism since the fall of their communist dictator and the exhaustion of the various warlords before America intervened, that relative Somali paradise was finally state of statelessness became the Islamic Courts Union, a government. 13 groups joined together to form a new government, the Islamic Courts, with one job: fighting the CIA-backed warlord, war criminals. And they did, and they beat them. They drove them across the border into Ethiopia at the end of 2005. And then through 2006, I forget exactly how the CIA was intervening and in trying to make up for this, but by Christmas 2006, Bush had the dictator of Ethiopia invade. And the Ethiopians and the Somalis are historical enemies because the Somalis are Muslims and the Ethiopians are Christians, and they have their history of war going back through the ages and whatever. And so, and the Ethiopian army with American help, special operations forces and CIA flying in their C-130s and, you know, blasting everything that moves on the ground. And the Ethiopians came in and raped and murdered women and children and committed, you know, horrible war crimes all across the country. And then they did succeed in destroying the Islamic State, the Islamic Courts Union. But then guess what? The smallest, weakest group in the Islamic Courts Union was known as Al-Shabaab, which means the youth. Now, previously, their job had been to sit in the back and be quiet while the elders were in charge of what's going on, tribal chiefs and religious imams and this kind of thing. Well, now that the Ethiopians invade, who picks up a rifle to fight? The youth. So now Al-Shabaab picks up their guns and beginning, you know, starting at the beginning of 2007, they are the insurgency that fights against the Ethiopian, American-backed Ethiopian invasion. And they succeed in eventually in driving the Ethiopians out. Then the Americans pay the Kenyans, the Burundians, and who am I leaving out? And the Ugandans to come in under the auspices of the Islam, under the auspices of the African Union. And then Ethiopia eventually reinvades too. For a time here, Al-Shabaab control the entire city of Mogadishu, the capital city. They control the major port town further south down the coast called Kismayo for years. And we're making hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars selling charcoal on the black market, clear cutting trees, just devastating the ecology in order to sell charcoal on the black market. And, but then when they got kicked out of there in 2012 by the Kenyans, they had to turn to the Saudis for money. And the Saudis have a condition, of course, and that is you got to declare your loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City, hiding out in Pakistan. And so at that point, only in 2012, 6 years after Bush invaded, which was had the Ethiopians invade, which was 5 years after the CIA started the trouble there in the first place, only then does this group declare their loyalty to al-Qaeda. So now, then you wonder how come it is that Barack Obama and Donald Trump kept bombing the place for another 12 years after that. And the answer is, well, they say they're Al-Qaeda now. Yeah, exactly. The problem that they caused and created out of nothing, where there was nothing. And if you go back and read the Washington Post from 2006, I swear to God, you'll find this in the Washington Post from 2006. They go, well, listen, we had to do this because somewhere in Somalia, there are said to be three men who are wanted for questioning by the FBI as possible suspects in the Africa embassy bombings of 1998. So remember, in the 1990s, before September 11th, the deal was terrorism, bin Ladenite, Al-Qaeda terrorism is a job for the FBI. And they even sent the FBI all over the world to do the Africa embassies and the USS Cole case. And they indicted these men and prosecuted them in court, right? It was after September 11th, Dick Cheney decided this is a war and now we torture them and bring them to black sites in Guantanamo and just blow them away rather than this old stuff. But these guys were from back in the 90s. These guys were, according to the cops, to the Post, suspects, possible suspects, wanted for questioning in the case. For in other words, for all we know, the FBI doesn't even think they did it. The FBI thinks they might know who did it or might know something about it, is the way it sounds. So America supported a war, started a war to catch three guys who were wanted for questioning. And then here's the worst part, and I'll shut up about it, is they've had horrible droughts in 2010 through 11, and again in 2017, had horrible droughts in the Horn of Africa. Kenya, Eritrea and Ethiopia and Somalia were all hit. But in Somalia, they starved to death. because in Somalia, it was wartime because of the USA. And so everyone else had market economics of some kind. I mean, Eritrea is basically a communist country, but they got some kind of rudimentary markets for distributing food to people to eat. But in Somalia, no. In Somalia, the farmers couldn't plant their crops. They couldn't sell them. There was no market. There was no customers. There was no transport or distribution. The entire system of distribution of food to the civilian population was decimated. And so what happened was, as of 2013, a quarter of a million Somalis had laid down and died. 250,000, more than half of them, of course, children under 5 years old, had starved to death. And that doesn't count the more recent famine that took place in 2017, again, which hit them harder than hell because of America's war there. And any food aid that the international organizations or the UN or anybody try to bring doesn't get to anyone except the warlords steal it and use it for power. And so you're talking about the most powerful organized monopoly on violence in the history of the world, picking on the poorest, weakest, most defenseless people who never did anything to us, who never so much as threatened us in any way. And now for going on 20 years.
It baffles the mind. So I guess before, when I asked, like, what's the difference between, ancient warfare and modern warfare? So, you know, modern warfare seems to become almost this, the monopolistic nature of it seems to be greater. So you know, it's far more centralized today because you have, you know, this effective empire that is America, whereas, you know, maybe in the ancient times, you know, warfare was a little bit different because it was a little bit more decentralized. There wasn't, you know, maybe other than the Romans, there wasn't a real monopoly on warfare. You also didn't have the capacity to print money to, you know, to fund warfare in the same way as we did back then, although they did clip coins and things like that. So, you know, and they sort of sent themselves bankrupt. And I guess it's a different scale, but, you know, could we say that the raison d'etre, like the reason for war, has always been the same, but maybe the scale has changed? Or do you think that modern warfare by the nation state is actually, you know, more of an aberration than what it was in the past, even though, you know, what's been a little bit more modern has been more surgical in that sense. Like, we haven't, you know, just carpet bombed everyone, but the reasoning behind it more deranged than maybe what it was from an ancient standpoint. Like, I'm curious just about almost the psychological element behind why just go and fucking wage war? Because back in the ancient times, it was, you know, it was a land grab. There, you know, there was a big discovery process, you know, that there was, you know, humans emerging from, you know, nothingness basically, and kind of building civilization, which is a messy process. But today, arguably, we have civilization, we have commerce, we have hygiene, we have all this shit, but we're still fucking killing each other. So it's like, what's the psychological triggers? Like, what is the differences there? That's kind of,
yeah,
I'm curious about.
Okay, so I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy. He's an important writer back in the days before World War II and just after, for the Saturday Evening Post. His name was Garrett Garrett. So the first word, it's one R and one T, and then his last name is two R's and two T's. I guess that was his pen name.
Fantastic.
I don't know. But seriously, it's such important stuff. Garrett Garrett, okay? And you guys should all read this. Audience, read this. It's short and sweet. You'll love it. It's called X America. You'll find it on Amazon or whatever. And that's actually one of the three chapters. It's three parts. It's the first one is called The Revolution Was, which is about the New Deal and FDR taking, you know, and the revolution within the form of the U.S. government during the New Deal. And then is X America is the middle one. And then the end is Rise of Empire, which I think came out in 1955. So it's these three essays together. You'll find it was originally published. It was called The People's Pottage, but it's now been republished as X America. But anyway, it's really great stuff. You'll love it, I swear. In Rise of Empire, he says, he points out what we were talking about before, about how in the American Empire, everything goes out and nothing comes back. So the fortune to be made is not in stealing Iraqi oil or in stealing Iraqi gold. The fortune is in ripping off the American taxpayer to sell them the equipment that you use to kill Iraqis, and it's all a loss, right? Just again, like in Orwell, it's made to be a loss. The war effort is a method to take your excess wealth and sink it into the ocean so that you can't get to it. We call it the floating fortress, right? An aircraft carrier. It's our floating fortress. Its real purpose is to take money from you so that you can't have it to improve your life. And the same thing with our rocket ships, you know, and all of our planes. All of that is to take your wealth from you and blast it off into space where you can't reach it, you know? And, you know, for them to live on their plush estates in the meantime. And that's the whole thing. I mean, this is the problem. This is the conundrum. This is why so many libertarians become anarcho-capitalists, right? Because we recognize you got to have capitalism. You have to have property rights. You have to have trade. But we also recognize that men are damn devils. And if they have political power, you could buy a congressman for a dime a dozen. And that congressman will rig the game for the rich, for the people who have already made it at the expense of everybody else. I mean, look at what's happened in the last few days. Some nobodies in the world figured out a way to stick it to the hedge funds in New York, in the marketplace, the same hedge funds that bet against companies and help to destroy them, even when they might have survived otherwise, and chalk it up to, hey, that's laissez-faire free market capitalism, right? And then the moment the little guy hits back, they shut down the markets. They banned all the apps where people can buy stock retail. You can't even buy Nokia or GameStop or anything else. They shut it all down. They intervene. They shut down the Discord channel. They called it white supremacy. It's white supremacy when you buy stock in order to screw a hedge fund that bet against it. Got that? They'll do anything. They'll do anything to rig the market. So that's why we become anarchists, because we say, listen, as long as there's a Washington, D.C., as long as there is such a thing as that power to abuse, corrupt capitalists will buy and use it. But so what are you going to get rid of, the capitalism or the state? You can't get rid of the capitalism. That ain't going to work. Well, we've seen how that goes with the mass starvation and, you know, pretended controls, even assuming people mean well. You have the socialist calculation problem and the central planning problems where they just can't know which resources should go where. It takes prices to determine which resources should go where. It's just as simple as that. But any leftist, any socialist or any progressive or any communist who tells you that you got a problem as a capitalist, the fact that it is because men are corrupt, capitalism is corrupt. But remember, the ism at the end of that means the system of state power, right? Markets and property is one thing. Market economics is one thing. Capitalism means a system where capital controls the state, right? That's something else. And of course, it's, you know, one of the worst things that libertarians have going for us, of course, is that leftists think that we're always trying to defend the status quo. When in fact, if you, as you said, you read your Rothbard, then you know the greatest enemy, at least in our conception anyway, maybe we're fools, but in our conception, and I'm pretty certain we're right, the greatest enemy of these concentrated forms of corrupt capital is the free marketplace, just like what Reddit proved yesterday, just like, which is a proof again, that in order for things to be the way they are, these monopolies need government to protect them. It's not capitalism that creates monopolies, it's government, because it's the first monopoly. And the only way to have a real cartel that survives
100%.
Is
100%. I actually
see with your congressman.
I was having this conversation with someone today, and I mean I gave a talk actually back in Vienna at this conference where they brought Bitcoiners together and central bankers, and my actual talk was entitled "How Austrian Economics and Libertarianism is Impossible Without Bitcoin," because as soon as there's a monopoly on the creation and the printing or the production of money, you start to actually have all the other monopolies coalesce around it. Like, so right. Natural economics, free markets, it's impossible to create a monopoly in a free market, because the larger something gets, the more fragile it becomes. And because life and nature is, you get things that grow and then crumble because the new competitor comes in and eats away at it. Whereas in a system where the original monopoly exists, i.e. the state, you can then create a beachhead basically of how close can I get to the monetary spigot? How close can I get to the institute that has the monopoly on violence, ethics, and morality? And let me cover myself with that. So instead of the free market protecting me, which is exactly what you're talking about now with this GME thing, with the Reddit stuff, is instead of the free market, doing its thing and, washing out the shit hedge funds, they go and run to daddy and say, oh, these bad white supremacists over here broke our hedge fund. Fuck you. So apologies for the swearing, but it's like, it drives me absolutely mental how fundamentally rigged the game is in that sense. It really pisses me off. But
yep. And that's the core of the warfare state too. That's what it's all about, man. It's the corruption of the American Republic. You can either have a constitutional republic or you can have a world empire. And in fact, maybe you just can't have a constitutional republic. This is the story of Star Wars. This is probably why I'm like this. The story of Star Wars is you had this old republic where people were free. And so they became wealthy. And then they became corrupt. They used their wealth to build giant armies and kill each other. And they ended up turning their republic into an empire. And even though it was the evil Sith conspiracy to do it, Palpatine needed a corrupt Senate to bribe, and he had one. He needed a corrupt culture to bribe, and there was one. And in fact, if you read the novel of Star Wars, like original one from 1977, there's a prologue at the beginning where they say that with great liberty comes great prosperity, and then with great prosperity comes great greed to match. And so it was that the old republic rotted like a mighty oak tree from within. And this is the story of us. George Lucas was writing about the United States of America. Mm-hmm. We are the republic that gave its democracy away to become a corrupt, evil empire soaked in the blood of innocents. Their Star Destroyers are just American aircraft carriers. That's all it is. The Ewoks are the Vietnamese. Okay? That's what that story's about.
It reminds me of the metaphor, which you've probably heard, the hop cycle, which is, hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good right. times bring about weak men. Weak men bring about hard times. And the cycle repeats itself. And that sort of seasonality, in some ways, I believe, is hard to, like, me and Giacomo Zucca, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's brilliant. He's on Twitter. He's a Bitcoiner. He's a physicist, the libertarian. He was in the Libertarian Party in Italy. The guy's brilliant. And we sort of had this discussion a couple of weeks ago about, if the inevitability of these cycles, exists, like what is there anything we can do as individuals to maybe diminish the bad times, or lower the amplitude, or decrease the frequency of some parts. But anyway, that's a much broader question. I want to ask one here, which is, kind of related to what we just discussed, in this sort of inevitability of the cycles. When is war necessary?
Well, for the United States of America, never. I mean, we could talk about philosophical stuff. I'm not really that smart, man. I'm more of a names and dates and stuff like that kind of a guy. Mm-hmm. As far as like all the conceptual philosophical stuff, I have a few comments. But, the main point is that this is the era of phony wars. I mean, look at a mm-hmm. map. America has two weak and friendly neighbors who could never conceive of threatening us. We have two oceans that no power on earth could possibly cross to put boots on our ground ever. You know, I quote in the new book, a quote from Abraham Lincoln. This is, all the armies of Europe combined could not take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. If our society dies, it'll be by suicide. If we lose our freedom, it'll be by suicide. No one could invade this land ever, ever. And in fact, imagine it. Let's pretend, okay? Britain and France and Germany decide to build up a giant fleet of troop ships and send their men to our East Coast. How far inland do you think their Marines get before Americans slaughter them all to death? Like a tenth of a mile? I mean, past the sand? I mean, maybe if it was a sneak attack in the middle of the night, they could get past the beach somewhere. But could they take a single town and hold it for a night? No, no. Okay? If the Chinese sent their entire male population to build a bridge across the Bering Strait and invade down into North America, could they get from Alaska into BC before we stopped them? Right? So no one threatens us. And the only way anyone could threaten this country is with nukes. And the only reason, 95% chance, the only reason anybody would ever shoot a nuke at this country is because we started it. The problem here, my friend, is that America is the world empire, and it's not supposed to be. Nobody's supposed to be. But at the end of World War II, we inherited the empires of all of Western Europe and Japan. The Reds got the Soviet Union and China, and we got the rest. And it's not outright colonialism, right? We didn't replicate Italy's adventures in Africa and this kind of thing. It's more like coup d'etats and briefcases and CIA most of the time, and war also some of the time. Call it a neo-colonialism, where sign here or we'll kill you, and then we'll extract some of your wealth. And you promise to buy our debt and this kind of a deal. And then, but again, just look at the map. This is the middle part of North America. And our task is to be the dominant military and political force over the rest of the old world, over not just Latin America and our hemisphere, like some Monroe Doctrine thing, but we're to be the dominant force in all of Europe forever. All the way to Russia's border, and then some, maybe someday, America and our military alliance are dominant. We are to be the dominant force in all of Africa, the dominant force in Central Asia, in East Asia, forever. And for what? For what? Just because some egghead said so, who got paid a few $100,000 from Lockheed to pretend to believe it. That's it, man. That's it, for no good reason at all. So this is why we had a border dispute with Russia in Georgia. And I don't mean the one between Florida and South Carolina. We had a border dispute with Russia in what we call former Soviet Georgia. Between, and Americans have no idea. If I ask an American, show me, even guess.
Between the
Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. In the southern Caucasus Mountains. We had that problem not because Russia is an empire, but because America is an empire. That is way, 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 say 9,000 miles east of its proper jurisdiction.
So what do you say? So what do you say to somebody who would turn around and say, okay, well, if we're not doing this, the Americans, what's to stop someone like Russia or China doing it to us or doing it to everyone else? What's to stop, you know, game theoretically speaking, the reverse happening? So, you know, someone might say attack is the best defense. And as a result, if we keep them unstable, you know, we can make sure that someone doesn't do it to us. Even, and maybe the intent is not even, you know, to maintain peace, but the intent is to just say, look, you know, self-preservation, self-defense, the best defense is attack, so let's just keep them unstable. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, that's a big part of the doctrine. In fact, I wish I could rattle off the exact quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski, where he talks about keeping the allies in check, the enemies in fear and the barbarians down and something. I forgot the exact quote. It was something along those lines. But I'll go back to the map, go back to the globe and spin it. And the fact of the matter is every power on Earth is a friend of ours, right? Despite all the hype about Russia and China, they're not our enemies. China's our second biggest trading partner behind Canada, and we've been friends with them. We ended the Cold War with China in 1974, 2 years before I was born. Nixon and Kissinger went over there and shook hands with Mao Zedong, history's single greatest monster, and said, instead of being enemies, let's split you off from the Russians and you'll be friends with us instead. Okay, that is how unnecessary it is for us to have a Cold War with China. We've been friends with them for 50 years. All right. The other power that you mentioned, Russia, is no power at all. Russia has the gross domestic product of Italy. That giant space on the map, first of all, if you're looking at a flat map, Russia's not that big. It's just north. And that's your Mercator map is a little bit twisted. Look at the globe. There's an accurate representation of the size of Russia. And my friend, it's all tundra, right? Moscow is all the way there in the far west of the country, and all the major cities are. And then you got to go thousands of miles to get to Vladivostok and whatever on the east coast. It's almost all Siberia. It's like, I don't know what the percentage of Russia is Siberia, but it's a huge percentage. So don't look at the map and think, wow, what a great power. They're not a great power. What makes them a great power is that they have 7,000 H-bombs. Mm. That's great power. But you know what? They have one aircraft carrier, one, and it runs on diesel and it's broken down. Okay, they brought it to Syria to launch their airstrikes. They had to tow the damn thing home. Okay, that's what a threat they are. USA is the world empire. USA dominates. We have 11 active carrier battle groups dominating every ocean and sea on the planet at all times, with no exceptions ever. No other country in the world has a pretension to that power at all. Before us, it was the British. But the idea that India or China or Brazil, or I don't know, I'm trying to make up, again, there's no lost continent of Atlantis here. There's so few powers to choose from to even talk about. What, Japan is going to rise again and become militarist again and try to close all the sea lanes? Why would they do that? It doesn't make any sense. And if you're a Communist Party official in Beijing right now, you're looking at the United States of America and saying, we can't wait till these guys have spent themselves all the way into the grave so that we can take their place and replicate their exact same idiotic suicidal behavior. Well, this is a nation with 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years of history where they've been consolidated since the Qin dynasty, and they've been a world empire never. Okay. If you're Tibetan, then they're a world empire, okay? If you're anyone else in the world, they're not. They never have been. And they would be absolutely as stupid as a Bush or a Clinton to try it. And why would they try it? They've spent the last 20 years.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't. Go on.
Okay, so we spent the last 20 years spending $7 trillion, just wasting $7 trillion killing people and not truly expanding our dominance and influence in any way other than in counterproductive fashions. And the whole time, China has spent pennies on those dollars, expanding their influence throughout the Middle East and Central Asia and Africa by sending little guys with briefcases full of money to make deals. Not even CIA style, where you do this or we'll kill you, but just, hey, you want a briefcase full of money? Let's do business. They're the communists with a big red flag. And we're the ones, and literally, not just invading countries, but our guys even talk about their domino theory. Once we invade Iraq, it'll knock over all the other dominoes in the region. Well, who's the evil empire now? Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing is crazy. And if you're the British or the French or the Germans or the Italians, you can't afford to take over the world at these prices, right? If America got out of Europe, all of these countries have every reason in the world to stay as integrated as possible with each other's economies, with each other's cultures and relationships, and nothing to fight about. They'd be crazy to fight. There's nothing, and they have everything in the world, back to modern technology, even short of nukes. France and Germany and Britain and I don't know about the Italians, but anyway, the three major powers of Europe have the ability to completely destroy each other, right? To just rain absolute havoc on each other's populations and to lose everything over what, you know, over what imagined slight are Britain and Germany going to go to war again in the next 100 years when all they have to do is get along. And meanwhile, you know, I think probably anyone, you know, looking at it objectively would agree, right, that the two worst things that ever happened, ever, was when Russia fought Germany twice in the 20th century. Nothing else that ever happened any other place was worse than that, okay? And especially in World War II. And now, right now...
Explain why.
Well, because, you know, 60 million people were killed. Okay. It was Holocaust upon Holocaust upon Holocaust upon Holocaust in the war between Germany and Russia. And in fact, you know, the official story is that 27 million Soviets were killed in that war. But I was told by someone who I think probably knows better that the real number was 40 million were killed. And just Stalin wanted to play it down because he didn't want to admit how weak they were at the end of the war and how devastating their losses had been. And the Americans wanted to also play it down because they wanted to pretend that the Soviet Union was a big bad empire that we need to arm ourselves against. And so everyone just kind of agreed to pretend that they only lost 27 million people instead of the real number that was about 13 million more than that. So this is absolutely the worst thing that ever happened. And if anybody has just like a kind of a detached objective idea of what is good for humanity in general, it's a solid, sturdy, productive economic and political and familial relationship between Russia and Germany. Let's make them friends. Let's do everything we can to make them dependent on each other's economy, to encourage them to embrace each other's culture, to put the bad days behind them so something like that could never happen again. And these are two would-be major powers on one little continent here, okay? So they have a project right now to build a giant gas pipeline from Russia to Germany, so that the Germans can buy Russian natural gas. And yet the American empire, and I'd like to just say, oh, that was just Donald Trump, but Trump's going along with this. This wasn't his policy. The American empire's policy is to sanction our allies, the Germans, and do everything we can to prevent them from building a gas pipeline to import Russian gas. Why? So that some Texan gas companies can make a little bit of money? Or so that we can lord it over the Germans that, ooh, if it wasn't for us, who would protect you from the Russians? When the Germans might even find their sense of humor in that one, if they were buying $1 billion worth of natural gas from Russia every year. And so we do everything we can to prevent that under Obama, Trump, and now Biden too. America is the evil empire. America is the disruptive force here, and they're threatening the existence of humanity, okay? They're threatening to cause a war in a completely unnecessary way. It's like picking a fight with Iraq, as unnecessary as that was. But imagine picking a fight with Iraq when they're armed to the teeth with nukes, you know? And they do have a million-man army that could actually, for example, invade Eastern Europe. Like right now, the Russians have no intention of invading the Baltic states or Ukraine, but I bet Joe Biden could provoke them into invading Ukraine if he tries to bring them into NATO. And then he'll say, what, this is Russian aggression? This is American aggression. Let me ask you this. if the Russians try to bring Canada into the Warsaw Pact, but they elected a pro-American leader, and then the Russians hired a bunch of Nazis to do a coup d'etat in Ottawa and install a Nazi-backed pro-Russian junta, and then that government wanted to join Russia's Warsaw Pact against America. You think America would consider that no big deal? Or they would consider that aggression against the United States? And the answer is, of course, America would nuke Moscow before they let that happen. They would start the nuclear war before they let the Russians overthrow the government in Canada. They just absolutely would. And yet we expect that the Russians are supposed to just sit there and take it. As not only do we bring all of the former Warsaw Pact states into NATO, but we overthrow their governments in bloody Nazi-backed coup d'etats if they refuse. And I'll tell you a story. One more thing on this. You'll like it. Our new head of the CIA is a guy named William Burns. And things could be worse. He actually knows a thing or two about Russia, and in a productive way, maybe. But I'll tell you this. This is in the WikiLeaks. You can find it. Thank goodness for Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning, and Julian Assange, the American heroes, both, even though Assange is Australian. Because of these heroes, we have this document. The title is Niet Means Niet. And what it is it's William Burns met with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. And Sergei Lavrov told him, listen to me, Burns, Niet Means Niet. If you bring Ukraine into NATO, I want to remind you, we could be in Kiev in 2 weeks. You understand? In other words, the line is drawn. If you try it, we will invade and crush Ukraine. You will not bring Ukraine into NATO. He might have said any more than you would allow us to bring Canada into the Warsaw Pact, you dumb son of a bitch. Okay? And then William Burns took that message back to Obama. Niet means niet. They put their foot down. Well, listen, America would be absolutely insane. Well, first of all, they have no right or good reason in the world to want Ukraine into NATO. And it would be insane, and it would absolutely be an act of aggression for them to attempt to bring Ukraine into our military alliance when the Russians have already said, we will consider this an ultimate attack on our sovereignty that we will not stand for. And is that the kind of thing that crazy old senile old Joe Biden might do? Yeah. You know how I know that? He's the one who overthrew the government in 2014. And I know that that's a fact because we have Robert Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, who Biden is sending back to Europe right now. She's going to be the ambassador of the EU right now. And or assistant secretary of state for European affairs or whatever it was. It's Robert Kagan's wife, one of the worst neoconservatives of all, Victoria Nuland. And she got caught on the phone. The Russians leaked an intercepted phone call of her on the phone with a guy named Gregory Pyatt plotting the coup in Ukraine. You might remember the headline was that she said, fuck the EU. And everybody went, oh, boo-hoo, an American diplomat using the F word about our friends, the European Union. When? And they pretended like that was the scandal. Well, go and listen to it. Type in fuck
the EU, the real story.
And go listen to the phone call on YouTube, where, thank goodness, the Russians intercepted it and posted it. We had the right to know. By the way, Russia, if you're listening, there are still 30,000 missing Hillary Clinton emails we'd like to read. But anyway, if you go and you can listen to the phone call, and it's Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt plotting a coup d'etat. But then look at the date. The date is 2 weeks before the coup d'etat. I mean, not just the date it was recorded, the date it was leaked and posted on YouTube. The Russians intercepted the conspiracy, posted it in public, and then they went through with it anyway two weeks later. Yeah. She's on the call saying, Yats is the guy. Yatsenyuk. We want him to be the new prime minister. Guess who became the new prime minister? Yatsenyuk. Yeah, and we don't want Klitschko, the boxer. He's too inexperienced. We want to keep him on the outside rallying the public. So tell him I said no to the parliamentary position for him. on to the next guy, on down the list. She says, we're going to get the Vice President Biden to help glue this together.
So this leads me nicely into my next question. So in the last 12 months in particular, we've seen, you know, the whole of America kind of become deranged. Now, I don't know if a large part of that is because of, you know, the excessive censorship, the excessive hysteria in the media, and then also, you know, this just crazy censorship and everything. But from what it looks like, at least externally, is, you know, America's in a shambles. You've got, you know, a complete split down the middle, supposedly, because Biden supposedly got 70 million votes, which I still find extremely, extremely, extremely hard to believe. But, you know, you've got all this mess, right? So, you know, I call it the rise of the new Leviathan in the form of the technocratic elites, you know, who've managed to amass so much wealth thanks to their proximity to the state, the monopoly that is the state. So, you know, almost the state has unleashed its own fucking Leviathan that is now lording over it in a sense. So it's like you've got this state, you've got this military industrial complex, you've got this fucking corrupt media, you've got now this technocratic elite that's risen up, you've got Wall Street suppressing anyone who makes money other than them, so you've got this whole thing that seems to be breaking up. Do you think we should also add this sort of push toward the globalist agenda, right, the whole World Economic Forum and bullshit that's going on, like, you know, this Great Reset idea, do you think this is in some way poetic justice or some sort of retribution for all the meddling that America's done in everyone else's fucking business? Like, what's your thoughts on that as an idea?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a mystic or anything like that. I mean, I don't think it's karma or magic or anything like that. It's just consequences, man.
You can only
spend yourself so far into debt. You can only, and as you guys know with your Austrian background here, that the funny money doesn't just cause price inflation. It causes this horrible boom bust cycle where every 10 years, right when the little guy is just finally getting back on his feet, maybe getting the slightest cost of living adjustment to his salary, the goddamn economy crashes again and he's got to start all over again. And you have this happens every 10 years or every 12 years or so. And then of course they lie us into every war. Which is a lot of them. I mean, and so people are just, nobody believes anything anymore. They falsely accuse the FBI and the CIA falsely accused the president of high treason with the Kremlin for 3 years and then just dropped it. Oh yeah, that was bullshit. Never mind. Huh? And so there's a huge crisis of legitimacy, which there should be. I mean, the real worry here for me is that people, you know, I'm for people getting, you know, for power, getting more populist, right? I mean, I'm not an elitist in any sense, but I'm a libertarian, which is in a sense, a centrist position. Mm. It's just, I'm against everything instead of for everything, like the horrible so-called moderates are, when they're the real extremists, not me. Mm. But anyway, the real worry, right, is that liberals are becoming more and more socialist because liberalism has let them down. Right. Liberalism is the center left. Right. Liberalism is, you move any more to the right, you're a Republican. Right. That's who the liberals are. The Democrats, the Senate Democrats. Right. John Kerry or whatever. This kind of politics has let people down. So instead of moving to liberty, though, they move further to the left, further toward Bernie Sanders. And then on the right, they've been failed by conservatism, which is, you know, personified by the Bush family, for example, in their entire post-Cold War reign in the Republican Party. And it's so corrupt and it's so dishonest and it's completely discredited. And then so what have they got, though? Right? Without the country club Republicans, then you've got just the populist right, the more radical right, or, you know, nationalist right. And they're not necessarily better on things. And they're better people because they haven't been the ones with the power this whole time. You can give them that. Mm. But if the populist right really had the power, I mean, if Donald Trump was who he was pretending to be for them, would we be better off? Or yeah, maybe in some ways, but we'd be way worse off in a hell of a lot of ways too. And the same thing with the more socialist left. Look at the socialist left is all rallying around what's happening at GameStop. They love seeing these bets hurting these hedge funds and this kind of thing. You know, their heart's in the right place on a lot of things. But man, can you imagine what would happen if they got control of our agriculture policy? I mean, right now, it's run by corrupt, fascist, evil big businessmen at Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland. But at least their middle management knows how to sow a crop, right? I mean, you turn this whole project over to the government, we starve. So, I mean, not that we're at real threat of going full communist here or anything like that, but just left-wing radicalism is, you know, to be charitable, they're really bad on stuff about 2/3 of the time. They're really good on stuff about 1/3 of the time and could be really destructive. So what we need is instead of people moving further to the left and further to the right, as they abandon this centrist neoliberalism and conservatism that they've been stuck with, they need liberty. And they need to understand that what's the real problem, well, first of all, the real American way is freedom. That's our Declaration of Independence. That's what it's all about. The whole first premise of our thing is individuals are born free. We allow our government to exist at our pleasure in order to secure our rights, period. They work for us. That's supposedly the whole game. And if that was our highest political principle, then we wouldn't have to fight over all this other stuff. The reason we fight over everything else is because essentially, the entire American public are left-wing and right-wing deviationists from true liberty. And so what we need is we need them back. We need them to figure out that the best part of conservatism is where you guys believe in freedom. And the best part of liberalism and progressivism in this stuff is where you guys believe in freedom.
Well, believe in freedom,
believe in a rejection that's where of the domination by people who don't have the right anyway, however you want to phrase it for them. And this is where we ought to be able to come together. This is where we can have moderate consensus. Instead of Hillary Clinton and John McCain consensus about every horrible, evil thing in the world, we'll have consensus against all those horrible, evil things. And we'll come together, we'll be together, we'll oppose the wars. Together, we'll oppose all bank bailouts and corporate welfare and all this Wall Street corruption. Together, we'll oppose the war on drugs and the militarization of our police. Together, we'll support the decentralization of power from DC out to the states. And we'll embrace libertarianism. And the libertarians will lead the left and the right to better versions of themselves in order so that we don't have to have this fight. The government has too much power. And that's why everybody is so afraid of the other side getting a hold of it. But if we just devolve the power, we could all be friends again.
I think you touched on a really important point then, because that's kind of where I want to get to now. Is my question is, if we're more localized, you know, would these kind of wars or conflicts be as much of a reality? But before I hit that, I just wanted to make a comment about, you know, the whole Trump thing. So during the whole fiasco, you know, me being a libertarian, I abhor any version of the state, but the one thing I did like about Trump's motive, or at least the direction Trump was moving in, was, and I said this in an actual article I wrote, it was called Rest in Peace America, you know, the death of the American dream or whatever. And I kind of traced it back to starting with Lincoln, you know, removing the ability for the state to secede, you know, and forcing them to become some united state, and then, you know, the rise of the Federal Reserve, the income tax, blah, 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 and sort of, you know, how the American dream died thanks to the institution that became America. But what I liked about Trump, one thing that, you know, A, he didn't start any wars, which was fantastic, but B, he was actually, I think, a force for fragmentation, a force back towards more decentralization and less globalization. Because I feel like the biggest danger we've got with idiots like Biden, et cetera, is that we start to move, you know, back on the train towards, you know, this ridiculous utopian, which in reality is dystopian, notion that we can somehow control everything and everybody from one place, you know, by one set of bureaucrats. And if only the bureaucrats had all the power to make all the decisions, everything would be okay. And that kind of abhorrent disregard for how natural law functions and how individuals function is the part that drives me, you know, the most crazy. And I feel like Trump was at least in his call it, you know, bravado, call it whatever we want to call it. Like, he was actually a force to fragment that kind of, broader imperialistic grip for power. Would you agree at least with that sort of directionality with Trump?
Yeah, sort of kind of. I mean, the problem is that it all ended up becoming very counterproductive in a way, right? Because so here's what was supposed to have happened, right? Was Ron Paul was supposed to get elected in 2008 and take an office in 2009. And then what would have happened, I'd been in charge, the policy would have been called the return to normalcy, right? Like when, I guess it was Harding took over after Wilson, that now we're going to return to normalcy. We're going to have a limited constitutional republic. And the days of the post-Cold War empire, the unipolar moment and the new world order of H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and W. Bush, it's a failure, it's a train wreck, and we're calling it off, and we're going to return to normalcy and be a limited republic, okay? But the Americans, they're dummies, so they didn't vote for him. They voted for Obama. They thought they were voting for the opposite of Bush because he looked like the opposite of Bush, while Ron Paul looked just like Bush, right? Like German stock, Texas Methodist, Republican Party politician from Texas, all this stuff just... Car was straight out of the cloning booth as far as the public could tell, right? He was the real opposite of Bush. Obama comes in and just continues the same policy, picks up, continues the thing. But it's a disaster, right? He starts, what, four or five more wars, adds what, $10 trillion or more to the deficit, and the country's more, or the national debt, militarizes the police more, and, you know, all this chaos and dissension and all this stuff is going on. And so the American people, in a rejection of that continuing status quo of the post-Cold War, you know, because Obama, I guess the way I should have said it better was he's nothing but Hillary Clinton. I said he was George Bush. He's really Hillary Clinton is what he is, right? Which is, again, the same thing as the Bushes, the Clinton-Bush dynasty this whole time. So Trump is elected as a repudiation of the previous consensus. But Trump's a freaking basket case. Trump's not normal. Trump's not a return to normalcy. Trump is a complete freak show. And so even though you're right that he says, and this is what they hated about him, and this is why they framed him for treason with Russia, was because he said, not that he was doing anything about it, not that he had a plan to do anything about it, but he would just say things that essentially amounted to, I don't believe in America's divine mystical mission to lead the world forever. Sounds like a big stupid waste of money to me. Right. And that's what they hated. And if you listen to Biden, he says over and over, he says in his foreign affairs article a year ago, and he said it 2 days ago, our commitment to NATO is sacred. Right. This is our mystical destiny to be the leaders of the world. And Donald Trump doesn't believe in anything, much less mystical destinies. Right. And so somebody tells him a mystical destiny to lead the world, and he goes, I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what you really mean by that. Does that mean we spend a lot of money and get nothing for it? That's what it sounds like to me. And that's what it sounds like to him. Everything goes out, nothing comes back. But not only is this guy not Ron Paul, he ain't even Rand Paul. He ain't even Rand Paul's, you know, pinky toe. He doesn't know anything. He has no principles, no doctrine. He's not even really a white right-wing populist, just a pretend one, right? He's a billionaire from New York, a former Democrat who supported the Clintons his whole life, you know, his, their whole political lives. But he's such a narcissist and he's such a clown show. Even, I mean, look at the way he fought the Russiagate allegations, okay? You have a guy who's the best reporter on Russiagate in America. It's a liberal, a progressive. He would hate me for calling him a liberal. A progressive named Aaron Maté from The Nation magazine, the most powerful and most prominent liberal magazine in America, going back 100 years, 200 years or something. The Nation. And Aaron Maté destroyed Russiagate. I mean, mercilessly. Did Trump have the two or three brain cells it would have required for him to actually read those articles and sum up the information in them in some tweets? No. Instead, he spent 3 years crying like a baby. Witch hunt. Unfair. Not fair. Not true. Exclamation point. How about this for a tweet? Listen, everybody. Even the liberal Nation magazine has proven that this is a hoax, a COINTELPRO op. I've been set up by the FBI and the CIA. And here's the proof. Carter Page was a patriot and a loyal CIA asset, not a pro-Russian traitor. They lied when they pretended he was a pro-Russian traitor. He worked for the CIA, see? And he could have gone down the list. He could have gone down the list and explained how every little factoid that Russiagate was built out of was a damn lie. All of it. An edifice of nothing but vapor. But he couldn't do that. All he could tweet was, "Wah, you're being mean to me. I'm going to be mean to you back," because he's a stupid little kid. And so now what? Here's, I'm sorry, I got distracted. Here's the real point. Now, Joe Biden, AKA Hillary Clinton, George W. Bush. Now he's in there, and now this is the return to normalcy. We don't get a return to a limited constitutional republic under Ron Paul. We get a return to that evil world empire that you were just announcing. The globalist project of American domination. That is what happens when the adults take control of the policy back from the crying, tiny, idiot, you know, baby who made an abandonment of their insanity look unstable and crazy and made a return to the world empire that is destroying this country look like the calm and reasonable and rational thing to do. And and he 100% personally deserves the blame for that.
Yeah, I think I get the viewpoint. I think, you know, he, through a lack of finesse, probably fumbled what could have really good opportunity to, you know, drive America consciously away from this. I mean, to his defense, I think, you know, the media and the social media companies, the Clintons, the Bushes, like everyone against him, you know, they probably made it a lot harder than it could have been, because it's sort of like,
but when you're getting jabbed. He had a good agenda. He didn't have a good agenda. I mean, look, he ran on three pillars. His three pillars were anti-immigration, anti-trade with China, and anti-war, right? Well, his anti-immigration policy is a disaster. All he did was confiscate a bunch of land from a bunch of private citizens and build walls way out in the middle of a desert where nobody's crossing anyway, and just waste a bunch of money. And he did not decrease illegal immigration at all. It was all for nothing, nothing. And his trade war with China, you're an Austrian economist. I don't have to tell you that that is absolutely 100% counterproductive in every sense whatsoever. And anti-war, let me tell you, he didn't end any wars at all. When people say he didn't start any new wars, hey, guess what? Congratulate me, because I didn't burn my next door neighbor's house down for no reason. But actually, the guy who lived here before me, who set all the other houses in the neighborhood on fire, I've continued to pour gasoline on all of those, but I'm a hero for not burning down the house next door, huh? He murdered probably 100,000 Afghans with airstrikes, drone strikes, and other airstrikes. Tens and tens and tens of thousands of innocent people, all of them. They have no intelligence about who they're bombing over there. They have no idea who they're bombing over there. Innocent people. Okay, he escalated in Somalia. He escalated in Iraq. He escalated in Syria. He escalated in Libya. And not only did he escalate in Yemen, he vetoed the Congress's attempt where they passed the War Powers Resolution to force him to stop. And he vetoed it and refused to stop a war that probably on his watch killed something like 500,000 people, a war that he inherited from Obama and Biden. Obama and Biden started it really in 2009, but the worst part of it in 2015. And Trump kept it going for 4 years straight. He probably killed hundreds of thousands of people in those, again, just like Somalia across the way there, a country that never attacked us, never threatened us. You could say, yeah, but Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula bombed the coal and tried to bomb a plane over Detroit. And I'd say, yeah, that was the war from 2009 through 2014. This is the war from 2015 through now, which is the war for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula against their enemies, the Houthis. Oh, and also against the entire civilian population of the country.
Yeah,
we have the worst cholera outbreaks in generations. Donald Trump is a war criminal. He is guilty of crimes against humanity, no less worse than George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. They ought to all be locked in one little supermax cell together for the rest of their shitty lives. Donald Trump's a goddamn devil. There's nothing defensible about what he's done here. In fact, you know, Obama, being the pansy little bureaucrat that he was, he made the military come up with a bunch of checklists and a bunch of boxes you have to check before you kill somebody. And he tried to change the rules where you got to be a lieutenant colonel or something to call in a strike. Trump came in and said, forget all that. I want every bit of new rules that constrain your ability to strike, all of them canceled. And I want battlefield authority to call in strikes devolved all the way down the chain of command to the very lowest place, where any old sergeant can call in any strike on anything he wants. Within the law, I want you to loosen every single rule of engagement we have, James Mattis. That's your anti-war, anti-globalist Donald Trump. The butcher of Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, oh, and Chad, and Nigeria, and Niger, and Cameroon, and Sierra Leone.
Point taken. I think we need to do a round two because I know you're short on time. I want to talk about, so do you think we've got another 5-10 minutes or how's your schedule?
Yeah, let's do five.
Okay, cool. So I want to talk about, you know, if we were to, so solution-oriented sort of discussion here is, you know, talking about this stuff and uncovering it is one thing, you know, so we can point to this is fuck, this is fuck, this is fuck, this is fuck. You know, what do we do or what exists to be able to drive this toward some sort of recalibration towards normalcy? You know, and you know, I subscribe very much, you know, aside from sort of the ANCAP libertine, but fundamentally sort of to localism is, you know, the idea that you know, I would much prefer, for example, the disunited states of America, you know, 50 states. Let's give me 1,000 cities. Let's cut the fucking crap with nation states because you can't rule over large swathes of people if, you know, we accept the reality that we're all subjective, different individuals. You know, you can't just say, all right, blanket, we're going to treat you all the fucking same because you're all sheep and fuck you, you don't get an opinion, you know, depending on which one. So what's your thoughts on, and I have an answer to this question, but how do we get back towards a path toward localism and decentralization? Do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah. Well, for me, the answer one is anti-imperialism, right? You cannot have a republic and an empire. That's it. It's one or the other. And so that's always why step one has to be foreign policy dominates domestic policy. So we have to abolish our foreign policy. We have got to turn the Pentagon into a library like they promised it would be during World War II. And we need to sink all of our Navy except just a few ships off our coast to protect us from a threat that's not coming. And then begin to be a constitutional republic. And you know, our constitution actually describes a federal republic, right? It describes United States of America. And so, you know, reinstating the constitution, in other words, would be a huge step towards going back to the Articles of Confederation, or even as you're saying, just to city states and county seats and devolving the power as much as possible. But the first thing, the highest order of business has to be anti-imperialism, which, you know, if it, I guess, based on the understanding that that's why the power is also centralized in DC. We stop the wars, then we can get to work on the rest of this stuff. And then, so my first strategy for stopping the wars is to attack the right from the right. Now, I'm a libertarian, which makes me more left than the left on some things, but that also makes me a hell of a lot more right wing than the right on some things. Like, for example, I hate, I mean, like a bitter child, I hate the IRS more and better than any right winger. I hate paper money. I hate it. And I can go off and I can take a position for hard money in the name of anti-corruption, right? In the name of real free markets against corporatism, against favoritism for the rich and powerful, and against a rigged market that drives people towards socialism because it's so corrupt. People think whatever this is, if this is capitalism, we want the opposite of that. So if you want to preserve capitalism, you better listen to me. We got to get rid of the income tax and we got to get rid of our paper money system. We need hard money. But my friend, you can't have hard money and a world empire. You can't have a limited republic and a world empire. You can't have it both ways. You have to make your choice. Let the Middle East go. Let Europe and Asia go. They don't belong to us. Us meaning the people of this country. It's not ours to dominate. And then you attack that. And listen, we've been through 20 years of this. So guess what? We got millions of veterans who've come home from these wars, literally millions. And at least hundreds and hundreds of thousands of whom, in fact, no, I mean, millions of whom, because we know from the polls, it's what, 56, 57% of the veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars, never mind the older wars from the last century, but just from the wars of this century, they're opposed. They wish that the Iraq war and Afghan wars had never happened in the first place, is how they answer the poll questions now. So what we need is conservatives and libertarians, really anyone who's not a leftist, and no offense to the leftists, because we need the leftists to keep their pressure up on the liberals, no question about that. But on the right, we need, and for the American public at large, we need libertarians and conservatives to put anti-imperialism first and to talk about it in libertarian and conservative language, in favor of markets, in favor of limited government, in favor of the rule of law, in favor of the American way, the real American way, the way it's supposed to be. Thomas Jefferson said, the spirit of this country is totally adverse to a large military force. That's what European nations are about. That's not what America is supposed to be about. It never was. And if we have people who don't talk like hippies, don't talk like liberals and Democrats, but talk like conservatives, and especially military veterans and especially combat veterans among them, if we have them really leading the push against the American empire and against American intervention in the Middle East, that's where we get the most bang for our buck and get the, you know, the ability to move the margin the furthest with the least amount of pressure. I'll give you an example of what should have happened last year, except the stupid germ ruined everything. But if it hadn't have been for the germ, we had a plan where there's this great new group called bringourtroopshome.us, which is libertarians, Ron Paul guys, basically, combat veterans of the wars, right? And they haven't moved left. They just got smart. They're still basically Republicans, right? And so what was going to, and they're basically pro-Trump. Certainly they're pro the things he says when he says good things about the wars. And so we had a plan. They had a plan to go to all the Trump rallies. And then whenever he said anything non-interventionist at all, they were going to, in their uniforms, start breaking in to bring them home, bring them home. And then if we could have done that and had them follow Trump around and have, you know, local chapters of the group, local veterans showing up to support too, and have veterans with flags, not hippies with their grungy old Vietnam flak jackets, right? But like, you know, current guys dress nice in their uniforms with their flags, pro Trump, but serious and holding him to it, right? Not just fans who believe in him, but bring them home. Not just we like what you say, but we really mean it. We demand it of you. You want our support, Mr. President, bring them home. And just imagine if that had been even part of the narrative of last year, if the germ hadn't been here. And every Trump rally, or say 8 out of 10 Trump rallies that happened all spring and summer long, you had anti-war veterans, pro-Trump veterans, not hippies protesting, not liberal anti-Trump guys, but conservative pro-Trump veterans at these rallies chanting, bring them home. That would have been so powerful, almost as powerful as Trump himself denouncing the wars. And think how powerful that was when he ran in 2015 and 16 and told the American right, we don't believe in George Bush's wars anymore, do we, everybody? And they all answered, hell no. Not if you say we don't, Donald Trump. And he led, that's the best thing that ever happened to the American right in terms of foreign policy ever, was Donald Trump. That's what I'll give him the best credit for of his whole presidency, is when he said anti-war stuff, he got right-wingers to like that stuff and repeat it. And it's right. It isn't like he was wrong and he fooled them. They had been fooled. He was setting them straight. Mm-hmm. We never should have been over there. It's obvious. The whole thing's crazy. Everybody knows that now. We never should have done it. Anybody would agree with what the anti-war movement said in the first place at this point. And so there's a huge potential there. A huge potential to have to attack the right from the right, to have conservatives and libertarians and especially veterans attack American foreign policy in a way that undermines the last public support for intervention. And you know, our government can do whatever the hell they want. It doesn't matter what the people think on 99% of every issue. However, I don't think that they can have wars without any public support. You know, if the American right wing, the Republican Party voters of America, by and large, do not support a war, you just can't have it. In fact, look at when Obama wanted to bomb Syria in 2013. The entire American right said, no, no. And we don't give a damn if there's a gas attack or not, which there wasn't. It was all fake anyway. Well, there was a gas attack, but it was false flag done by Turkey and Al-Qaeda. But anyway, the American right wing said no, and they didn't do it. They didn't do it. Obama punted to Congress because he knew Congress would kill it. In fact, he called Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and he said, tell your people, vote your conscience. In other words, do not whip them. Do not make them vote for this. Tell them explicitly they don't have to. And that was because there's just no public support for the war.
Interesting. I agree with you. I think there's a stronger strategy, but I would love to continue this because there's a couple of things I want to dig into, which is decentralization. I want to dig into the separation of money and state as a place to really almost drive a stake through the heart of.
So I agree with all that stuff. I agree with all that stuff. I'd belong to the cult of Bitcoin if I ever had any money to play around with it or anything like that, which I don't. But I'm all for it. It's just not my expertise. But anything that people can do to make the state obsolete, and especially in terms of taking on the monetary system as you're talking about, has my full support, of course. As other than the Congress itself, the Federal Reserve is the problem. You know, you start with the Pentagon, but where's the Pentagon get their money? You couldn't have this empire without the Fed. And then you couldn't have the Fed without the Congress. So they're ultimately, they got to go. But the Fed is the creature from Jekyll Island, as Ed Griffin called it back when. And that's basically the deal, you know?
I think that for me, like out of everything, is the most powerful form of protest. Because if we break the monopoly on money, you know, the state bankrupts itself a lot faster. I think, you know, one of the things I really learned from Hopper when he, if you've read Democracy, the God That Failed, but he, you know, he discusses in there how the, even though monarchies were bad and, you know, they're not the greatest form of organization, at least they were still bounded by how much tax they could extract from their people. They didn't have the ability to print unlimited amounts of money and therefore fund all the ridiculous types of wars that we sort of see today. So for me, I feel like that's one of the things, but I'd love to discuss that a little bit further, because I also want to talk about how warfare has potentially changed in 2020, particularly with stupidity like mask mandates and, you know, enforced lockdowns and just the crazy hysteria that we've seen over, like you said, a fucking germ, which I would argue that none of us would have even known there was a virus going around had we just continued living normally as normal human beings. But I think there's a series of topics there I'd like to dig on, but I know you're short on time. So would you be willing to do a second episode with me maybe over the next week or two?
Yeah, happy to do it.
Because I'd love to do that. And I'd also like to talk about the Enough Already book as well. I want to discuss what is effectively new is a cheap word, but like what the premise of Enough Already is and what you've brought to light in it that you haven't in particularly, you know, the principles behind like a fool's errand and things like that.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess get it read and then contact Ed after that and we'll talk about it.
I will, for sure. So Scott, thank you. I wish we had more time, but thank you for taking the time to come on for this, man. I really, really appreciate it. It means a lot. I think, you know, people in the libertarian space, like, it's crazy. You know, we've thought about things so much more than everyone, but we always get positioned as the supposed radicals or the psychopaths or the extremists, you know, when we're the ones trying to take the least extreme position. You know, we're like saying here, right, hey, a war is bad. And they're like, no, you're an extremist. Like, wait a minute. What part of let's not shoot each other up and let's not just print fucking money blindly is extreme? So it's
right.
It's always good to talk to someone who's particularly, I mean, I came into libertarianism through Bitcoin, actually. So the other way around, although I've always been an entrepreneur since I was young. Like, I had one job as a pizza delivery driver when I was young. And then I kind of built my life up through entrepreneurial escapades. And I learned how to be self-reliant and responsible. And that for me is, you know, the thing that I love about libertarianism, because it brings responsibility back to the individual, right, not something that you just give to the state and expect the state to fucking look after you and expect the state to make all your decisions for you and keep you safe and everything like that, such that the state can keep you in a constant state of emergency, which is right, which is what we're seeing. So yeah, man, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it a lot.